following interview with John Schaefer of Eyster is conducted by Eyster.com on April 3rd, 2008. It is copyright 2008 Platinum Dragon Entertainment. All rights are reserved. Eyster.com began the interview with John by asking him where the new song, I Walk Alone, from the forthcoming single, I Walk Among You, fits in part two of the Something Wicked saga due for release this fall.
Well, let's see. I Walk Among You, basically, it takes place at a point when Set acknowledged and accepted what he is and who he is and what his purpose is, you know. So it's kind of it's a little bit of his own personal revelation. I mean, it also is a, gosh, how can I say this? I mean, if Set is kind of he is the ultimate weapon, you know, in the story. He's the weapon against man. And as we've discussed and what's been established in Framing Armageddon, as that one of the big things that the Sessions do in the Order of the Rose is established throughout the planet is to, you know, they have created many different religions. And that's one way to keep man divided. The other thing with, after the clouding, when different languages were created, that's what the whole line Twisted Tongue Segregate refers to, is that from the point of the clouding, you know, if a guy's the humans that could speak to each other when they first invaded, now, you know, you've got basically guys that the black guys can speak to the black guys, the red guys speak to the red guys, but they can't talk to each other. And so they start to faction off and spread globally, and that's kind of that Tower of Babel idea, you know, but in my Something Wicked universe, kind of twisted around a little bit. So that's what the clouding involved in there. But if you look at what the concept of this, the whole religion keeps man divided, but then how do you really go after mankind? Well, you have to exploit weaknesses of man, and one of the biggest weaknesses is that human beings are consistent liars. It's probably the one thing that mankind does consistently and always has done, and the reason that you can say nothing has changed under the sun, you know, not for man anyway. I mean, yes, okay, we've gone from living in caves to taking ships into outer space, but really, our behaviors are the same. So Set is basically saying that he will be the weapon of truth against mankind. And that's what I Walk Alone is about. Like, he's, and you know, I know the title, I Walk Among You, I Walk Alone, has confused people, but it's part of it. It's on purpose, because he is everywhere at all times. He can be, you know, from the time of his birth, from the time of his coronation and the gauntlet, and when he becomes what he is, this weapon of destruction, you know, he's basically able to travel through the folds of time and space and to shapeshift into anything that he needs, any person, any, you know, he's just all powerful. He's an entity, you know. And so all of this manipulation of man's history and the events that go on, and also exploiting the very fact that that we, you know, tend to be very dishonest. Even for people that try to be honest and try to live life in an honest way, it's a very common thing that, I don't know if it's genetic or what it is, but, you know, people lie to themselves in the mirror all the time. Like, little stuff, big stuff, whatever, but it's a huge weakness. And so, you know, that and the whole idea of different religions and, you know, the fear that mankind has. I mean, men in general live in fear. They're in fear of what they don't understand. You know, it's, they're fearful of people of other races because they don't know them. They don't understand them. So, I mean, these are traits. And I guess, it wasn't really a very short explanation, but that's a little bit of a taste of what, you know, I Walk Alone is about.
The single also contains three tracks from Framing Armageddon, re-recorded with Matt Barlow on vocals: Session Massacre, The Clouding, and A Charge to Keep. Why did you decide to re-record those particular three songs?
That was actually Matt's choice. I just, because of the time that we had to prepare for this, when, you know, the main focus was, is really the full length album. And, you know, as I told you in the past that, and everybody, that Iced Earth doesn't do B-sides. I mean, we don't have like throwaway tracks. So to do, ideally, that's what a record company likes to have when they do something like a single. They would like to have a few extra tracks that will never appear anywhere else, or maybe in a box set later on down the road or whatever, but Iced Earth doesn't have that. So in order for us to, you know, give the people something extra besides the one song, we had to come up with something. And the idea was, we'll pick a couple tracks from part one for Matt to do, and, you know, which ones do you think you can learn and feel comfortable with singing in the short amount of time that we have to do that. These are the ones that he chose and that he likes. And, I mean, I really wanted him to do the Clouding. I was kind of pushing on that, and I knew he would do it brilliantly because, you know, that intimate stuff is, really, you know, Matt's just got a beautiful voice for that, that real close, in-depth kind of stuff. And the whole beginning part of the Clouding is that. And then Matt also has a very brutal, diabolical voice for that kind of stuff. So you got kind of the two, you know, the opposite ends of the spectrum there. And I thought that would be a great song for Matt to do. So anyway, that's that. But he really chose the ones, and I think they're great.
There are 11 live dates, 9 of which are European festivals that have been confirmed for 2008, with still more to come. Is a run of dates in the U.S. in the fall of 2008 still in the plans?
Yeah, definitely. It's being booked now. I think there's actually significantly more than 11 even going on in Europe. But, you know, as you said, there's more to be announced. But, yes, in the States, it's going to be happening around the Prague Power Fest. We are starting, I don't know, like in the 20th of September or something. And I think we're going to start in Toronto and Montreal, head to New York, down the East Coast. You know, work our way back up to the Midwest, and then we're going to take a short little break while Matt does a shift, and then the band heads out to California, and then he'll fly out and meet us out there, and we'll do some gigs on the West Coast. And then, you know, basically that's what we've got planned right now. There is this, the gigs are being booked as we speak. We just got through the routing and the timing and working with the schedule and figuring out how we're going to do it. And then there will be more legs after that, you know, that we'll be announcing as things develop. Probably at the end of April.
Right.
So yeah, it's going to be soon. I mean, we're wrapping. My new manager just kicks ass, man. And I mean, the guy is so like organized and so getting stuff done ahead of time. I mean, it's kind of a new world for me. I'm really enjoying it. And it's to be this organized this far ahead of the game. I mean, we've already got the summer basically done. Now it's just a matter of a few more dates being confirmed, working out details. But to be advanced this far ahead of time, and then to think by the end of April, our fall dates are going to be advanced, and it's just great, man. So, yes, it won't be long, because now it's a matter of just of booking it, and that's happening, as I said.
And the fans in Australia and South America, particularly Brazil, are really always planting a bug in my ear, and they'd love to see maybe not 2008, but how about 2009 for those territories?
It's very likely. It will happen. It might even be later in 2008. You know, we just have to see it. A lot of it depends on the scheduling, Matt's schedule, when his you know, the vacation times that we have, obviously, the vacation days that Matt has are very valuable, obviously. And we're going to try to use as many days of his normal shift days off as we can for, like, touring the States and doing it in different legs. And then utilize those vacation days for stretches like Australia, South America, and that kind of thing. So, I mean, it will happen. It's definitely, you know, it's definitely going to happen. There really wasn't much work done in Australia, like none, during the Century Media years. Little to none, let's put it that way. And, you know, getting, as I signed with SPV, things started to change. And now that has turned into a market that people are really, you know, into the band. We realize that, and we're making a little bit of a fuss over there, so we need to get over there and play for those guys. So it's going to happen. It's just, you know, figuring it out. We're also working really hard on getting USO dates happening so we can go and play for the troops in Iraq. That's something I've been working on for a while, but now we have a Congressional Medal of Honor recipient that is helping us out. And, you know, that guy's got some serious pull. So I think it's more realistic than it has been in the past, because it just seems very difficult to get somebody to respond. And I don't know if it's because of the type of music that Iced Earth is, or just the fact that we're not as huge as some of the bands that do USO tours, but, you know, we if any band that plays heavy music should be playing for those dudes, it's us, you know.
When I maintain the MySpace page for Iced Earth, it's just amazing. We get so many friend requests from people in the military, and they're actually in Iraq and in Afghanistan. It's just amazing to see how many people over there do listen to Iced Earth.
Oh, man, they're, you know, it's like, it's amazing. I love it. I hear it all the time, and I've got, obviously, I have a lot of friends that serve, and this, the troops know how much I care, and we care, and where our hearts are at, you know, concerning them and what they do. And I mean, I would love nothing more than to be able to give back. And so it's cool stuff, man. And I think the reality, you know, I mean, I've heard stories, a lot of guys, obviously, when we've been on tour, whether it's in the States or, you know, in Europe, whatever, guys that are stationed over there come and talk to me after the gigs and before whatever, and told me stories how they listen to Iced Earth right before they go in and do what they got to do. So it helps amp them up and get them pumped, and that's good.
The first live show in 2008 is coming up real quick. It's today's April 3rd, I believe, and then May 2nd is Chicago Power Fest, and it'll be the first time that you'll be performing with Matt Barlow since, at least 6 years, the end of the Horror Show tour. So what are you looking forward to most about that show, and what kind of set list can the fans expect?
Well, I think it's going to be a very emotional show for everybody, you know. And I think it's going to rock, man. I'm looking forward to it. I think we're going to, you know, I think it's just going to feel like we haven't missed a beat. That's actually what I expect, because that's exactly what it was like when we first started working together in the studio. Or even from the time that we got together in person after, you know, the change happened and we, you know, Matt came back to the band and stuff. It was just like old times, man. And, you know, for both of us, it was really cool. So I think it's going to be when we get out there, you know, yes, I'm quite a bit grayer than I was then. And Matt, has like no hair now instead of like 6 foot wingspan of hair. But, you know, it's in spirit, we're going to be stomping ass. It's going to be the same, you know? So I think, I don't know. I just really look forward to it. And the kind of set that we're going to be doing is, you know, we're going to play a few of the new tunes, but that's not what people are going to want to hear, you know? I mean, they'll want to hear a few songs, but I think the majority of people are going to really expect us to do what we're planning on doing, and that's doing a lot of the classic stuff from the era that we were, you know, what I feel is the best era of when Matt was with us, which is, you know, the Dark Saga, Something Wicked era. I mean, we'll be doing a few tracks from Storm Rider. We'll be doing more Horror Show songs, probably. But, you know, I think it's going to be loaded heavy on that era, Dark Saga, Something Wicked era, because it's just powerful stuff, man. It's going to be very pleasing to the fans, the mixture of songs that we picked. I mean, everything from A Question of Heaven to Traveling Stygian, Pure Evil, you know, Burning Times, the Something Wicked trilogy, the, you know, done the original way, all that stuff. Good stuff.
Let's ask you a couple questions, a little bit different. And maybe when we do these interviews in the future, I think I will try to give some of the gearheads out there a little insight into
what you do. And recently, you've been working with Jim Wagner of WCR Guitar Pickups to develop your first signature pickup called the Ice Bucker, which is a hand-wound and now available for purchase from WCR Guitar Pickups. We have a link for that on iceturf.com. So how did you come to know Jim Wagner, and what makes your signature pickup unique?
Well, I came to know Jim because when I first started, you know, when I built the studio and first started getting into the writing process of the Something Wicked saga, I was really like, knew that because of the task ahead that I was going to have to get very anal when it comes to guitar tones, and that I was going to have to have a lot of different colors that I've never been able to do before. I mean, that's one thing is in the past we just never had the budget or the time to be able to have many different guitar sounds. It was kind of like you get the tone and you record the record and that's it. And I didn't want to do that with this because there's so much to it and so much to tell that I wanted to be able to have different layers of sounds so that subconsciously it really never gets old or it never feels the same. And, you know, we even were able to do different drum miking techniques for some songs throughout, because that also is a dynamic thing that a lot of listeners won't really hear consciously, but their subconscious mind picks up on this kind of stuff. And some of it is very obvious, but there's a lot of stuff that goes on kind of subliminally. But these things are important, I feel, for storytelling and for something that's this epic, because it's just, you know, it's like having a lot of different colors on your palette, you know, and that's the whole point. So I was really getting really detailed in checking, doing pickup testing and what works the best for specific styles of playing. And so I started, you know, looking into different companies, and Seymour Duncan was one, Bare Knuckle was another. And I somehow came across Jim Wagner. I'm trying to remember how that, I think it was because, I know how it was. It was McNaught. David Thomas McNaught is a guitar builder, and he built a guitar for me. It's called the Phoenix Rising is the body style, and it's just a really cool guitar. And he, one of the pickups that he chooses a lot is a Wagner pickup. And there's a lot of boutique winders out there, but Jim has, you know, a very solid reputation. So I did some research on him, and I contacted him and ordered a few sets, and then I immediately found out why. And out of all of the different companies that I tried, Jim's just kind of blew everybody's away. I mean, musically, and it wasn't just me. It was like there was a time that we were, you know, Jim happened to be here, and I was recording, and I, you know, plugged in one of my Les Pauls and started playing. He goes, "Man, what's in that? What pickup's in that one?" I said, "Oh, that's a Wagner. That's a Wagner. It was probably either a Crossroads or a Goodwood, or what he's changed the name now. It's called the Godwood. But you know, the Godwood was probably the pickup that I loved the most from him. But I wanted to see if we could get just a touch more bottom end and more definition for the really intense picking. You know, it's been a problem through the years to be able to find a pickup that still gives me the note definition and the tone, but that, you know, that happens when you really do a hard mute on the strings. And when you're doing, you know, triplets at 220 beats a minute, you know, it's like fucking flying. And it's hard to make something that's that percussive really sound musical, you know. And a lot of times my guitar parts end up being more of a rhythmic thing than necessarily a guitar thing. You know, that was what we got in, what we started discussing. And, you know, basically he couldn't fit any more wire on the coils of the Godwood. It was just like, there was no way. So anyway, I'm not going to give away his, what he did, his technique was, but he was able to give me what it was that I was looking for. And, I think, you know, the thing that's cool about the Ice Bucker is it's still, you know, a very musical pickup. It's not a high output pickup. A lot of people, probably a lot of people that would hear my guitar tone would think that, but the thing is that I like vintage pickups more. I like the lower output pickup because it lets you hear the amplifier work and you're hearing what the guitar is actually made of. If you put a really hot pickup, like so many guys use EMGs, and those are really hot pickups, but the thing is, they make every guitar sound the same. I mean, you can put one in any brand of guitar, and all of a sudden, whatever personality that guitar had doesn't really matter anymore, because now it's going to sound like a guitar with an EMG pickup in it. And, you know, people want that. They want consistency. That's cool. But that's when I have a collection of guitars, I want those guitars to be able to give me different sounds so that I have a palette to choose from when I'm looking for a specific tone for a specific part of a song. And that's, to me, is the whole point of having different guitars, because every single Les Paul on this earth sounds different. I mean, yes, they sound like a Les Paul. They sound close. But if you really analyze the tone, there are no two alike. It's like a human being. The cell structure in wood, there is never a carbon copy anywhere. And it's the same thing with us. And it's just like that's going to have an impact on the sound. I mean, anytime you change a variable, it's different. And so, you know, my goal is to let the amp speak, let the guitar speak. And that's by having kind of a low output pickup, it does allow that. But it's, you know, I'm kind of getting off into a, you know, this is definitely discussion that like gear geeks get into.
there are a lot of them out there, believe me, that ask such questions. So
that, hence, what's that?
So there are a lot of them out there that, you know, ask such questions. And since I'm not a guitar player myself, that's why definitely as we do these interviews in the future, fans can expect that we, you know, touch on something gear related. If I have any questions that come in, I'll pop them.
No problem, man. Because I mean, I think a lot of guys could achieve what they're looking for if they, you know, get a little advice in here. Because you have to, you know, and the only reason that I got to the point was obviously from doing it for years. I mean, the first time I went into a professional studio and plugged up my rig, it sounded like ass. It was horrible. But you know what? That's because the way I was running my rig. It wasn't the studio's fault. It was me, not knowing what I'm doing. And, you know, when you rely on pedals to be the main source of your tone, or if you have a really high gain amplifier and you go and get a really high output pickup, you know, you're just doing it wrong. It doesn't, it's not the way to go about it. You know, I mean, I guess it depends on what music you're going for. I'm very happy with what we're doing, and also I have the, you know, between the Ice Bucker and the amp, the Larry Grohman signature amp that I have coming out. But it's basically my signature amp that he's building, and he's going to have, because we've been together 15 years now, and you know, he feels like this is the time to put out a signature model of the Larry amp, which, you know, a lot of people have been wanting, you know, to figure out how in the hell I get the guitar sound that I do. And I mean, it's part of it is, you know, it comes from within big time. I mean, I don't think a lot of people understand so much, especially when you first start playing, that a lot of a guitar player's sounds are in his soul and in his hands, and that translates. And then there's another percentage of it that is your gear and how you run your gear. It's like if I was to play through Eddie Van Halen's gear, play his guitar, his rig, I would never, for one thing, I'm not near the guitar player he is, but I would never sound anything like him anyway. And that's kind of the thing that, you know, if Ted Nugent came and plugged into my rig, he would still sound like Ted Nugent. You know what I mean? It's just a fact. It's the way it is. But, and people need, young kids that are growing up playing, I think they need to really sometimes not worry so much about sounding like their heroes and worry more about becoming an individual. You know, get those influences, but don't focus so much on worrying about how did he get the sound on that record. Worry about how you're going to get the sound on your record. You know, think that way, because if you set the goals high, you can achieve high things. It's a shame that the way industries shove this way of learning down their throat. You know, like you have to have these products and you have to buy these magazines and you have to, you know, play these licks and go about it this way. And it's just a crock of shit. You know, it just doesn't have anything to do with individuality. And I guarantee you that any of the big legendary guys didn't do things that way. You know, they focused on what they were doing. I mean, there's nothing wrong with wanting to emulate your heroes a little bit, but I think the wrong way to go about it is to worry about trying to play like somebody else plays or sound like somebody else does. You just have to find who you are, dig down deep inside, pull that shit out, and put it up there. You know, if you do that, you know, you have done something that 99% of the guys out there playing cannot do. I have to wonder, you know, sometimes how many kids would have really grown up to become amazing writers, players, artists that basically got stifled because of the way they went about their learning in their youth, you know? Because I think it has a big impact, you know? But anyway, whatever, that's, you know.
Talking about picking and pickups, some might sound like an odd question, but I do get it once in a while, and it is, what type of guitar picks do you prefer when you play? We know that you just have a really heavy, brutal, fast picking style, so what type of guitar picks best suit your style, and do you use different picks when you record in the studio, when you record rhythm passages versus like solo sections?
I like to use I've been using Clayton, I call them Harley picks because they've got like the Harley Davidson Eagle and it says Clayton USA. It's not the Harley Davidson Eagle, but it looks like that. And they're the big triangle things. They're like bass guitar picks, actually. Most guitar players look at them and go, dude, how the fuck do you use those things? And I don't know. I just love the way they feel. It's something that I can actually hold on to. It's big enough. I mean, I don't understand how the guys can play. There's some guys out there that play with picks that are smaller than the fingernail on my pinky. You know, I mean, it's weird, but they do it. You know, everybody's got their thing. But these are, they're 1.00 millimeter thick. Sometimes I use 0.80s. So that's what I use, like, all the time. Now, I have discovered, however, that it's really amazing how much a pick can make a difference in the tone when you're playing. It's a trip. I never realized that until Jim Wagner turned me on to a guy who has a company. His name's Vinny, and he has a company called V-Picks. And he makes these picks out of this, I'm not even sure what the material is, but it's a clear, like a hard plexi material of some sort. And, you know, it's see-through. And he does the sizes like the Claytons. And he does all these bizarre thicknesses and everything. And they've just got a really cool feel to them. And I ordered some of those from Vinny and did some specific playing, some of the same parts, same guitar, same pickups, amp settings, everything, and did some, you know, testing back and forth. And it was amazing how much one might sound darker, one performance might sound darker or brighter based on what pick was being used. And, I mean, I still found out that I do like the Claytons better, but I did use Benny's picks for certain lead guitar parts. You know, some of the melody lines and stuff like that, I just felt like it sounded a little bit better. So, you know, like I said, man, every variable makes a difference. You know, you can't really take, even if you were to say, if you were to put an ice bucker in two Les Paul standards that had the same finish and everything and play them through the same head, they're going to sound different. They're going to sound close, but they will sound different because it's a different piece of wood. It's every variable involved. You know, you would have to absolutely duplicate every single thing in order to do a true one-to-one test on some of this stuff. So that's what I would do when I was doing the pickup testing was I picked one guitar and I would solder in pickups, you know, several times a day, and I would go through and track, you know, say I'd do four rhythm tracks of a specific riff, and then, you know, solder in a different pickup into that same guitar with the same strings, same settings, everything, and play the exact same riff another four times and stack it up. And I did that with, shit, dude, I have files in my Pro Tools rig of, you know, like probably 50 different pickups where I was going through, and I would play some really fast pick stuff, some chunk stuff, some like open chord kind of things, different typical rhythmic things, and go through and listen to which tones I liked better for what. I mean, there was times like when Jim and I were doing, you know, tracking guitars, be like, okay, I got, I want to do this set of rhythm tracks with this guitar, but I got to change the pickup. So hang on a second. And I would solder in another pickup.
Solder, yeah.
And, you know, I mean, it's kind of like probably a little bit, overly nuts, but you know, at the same time, I never had the opportunity to do that kind of thing before in the past. And now having my own studio and being on a little more of a relaxed, you know, I can do it. You know, it's just, and the budgets are better now, and everything's better. So, I mean, it's just kind of, it's the stuff that I have always dreamed of doing, and now I can do it.
And talking about your own studio, fans that read the jackets will have noticed in Framing Armageddon Part 1 and then the upcoming single and full length that the name Soaring Eagle Sound does appear. And why don't you just tell us so briefly, what is that, where is it, and why?
Well, it's my studio on my property in the middle of the country, in the middle of nowhere. And it's actually a log home that, you know, it's got a killer vibe. I mean, you're out here, see herds of deer walking around and wild turkeys and whatever, because, I mean, it's really in the boonies. And, you know, it's just, it's great. It's like the vibe is really, it's a very cool place. Never, you know, no complaints about noise or anything. And, you know, for me, it's kind of the dream situation. It really is what I've kind of been working for my entire life, to be able to have a setup like this. And there is a very good possibility that someday when I'm, you know, in the frame of mind and have the time to produce bands, that you know, we could do that here. And we very well could and probably will. But at this point, it's not really open to the public. It would just, and it probably, it actually never will be in that sense. It will only be something that if I'm involved with a band, that we would use it. But I'm not ever going to be like, you know, setting it up like a recording studio, like Morrisound or, you know, Criteria, or it, you know, it's never going to be like that. This is going to be solely a private thing that will be used for projects that I'm used to doing.
We've been talking about the new release here on SPV coming out, the I Walk Among You single. But there also has been a new Iced Earth release by Century Media, which is a retrospective called Slave to the Dark, a box set. Did you have any input or collaboration with Century Media on this release?
No, I didn't. In fact, you told me about it.
Yeah, and somebody at MySpace told me about it, and I got on the internet, and sure enough, there it was. So.
Yeah, I mean, no, and I think, you know, people can expect this kind of thing probably forever from them. You know, it's kind of unfortunate in a sense, because I feel like they're taking advantage of people. In the same respect, I have to say it's a really nice package. I've seen it, and I think there's things that could have been better if I'd have just even proofread it. You know, they got stuff wrong. They got like the I on the logos is screwed up, and there's goofy little stuff like that that I noticed all over the place. But overall, it's a very nice package. You know, I think it's a cool thing for somebody who's just discovered the band in the last couple of years. You can buy that, and you've got a lot of stuff. You know, the majority of our catalog. I just kind of wish they would stop. You know, because to me, it just is really transparent. You know, it's pretty easy to see that they're just kind of trying to cash in as much as they can on the continued success of Iced Earth. And I mean, you know, I can't stop them from doing that. You know, it's not, it's just, that's what they do. And I, you know, like, I think people have misunderstood when I said that I got the rights back to, that means the title exclusivity expired. That means that I can retrack songs from the old catalog, like anything from those years. Like, put it this way, when we do the next DVD, I can do anything from the Century Media catalog. I can re-record that, and it won't be a logistical nightmare for, you know, the label that we're currently on to have to pay them. You know, that, like, in the past, if we would have done something like that before the title exclusivity came back to me, they would have had to have, like, whatever label would release something with those tracks on it, they would have to pay Century Media. So, you know, I don't have the masters. It's not like these things came back to me and I don't have anything to do with it. I mean, they have the power to do this kind of stuff from here till the end of time, and I bet they probably will. And they'll always figure out some way to justify it. You know, people need to realize it's not me, and I'm not trying to, like, soak people for a bunch of money, because the way those deals were structured, you know,
you're not getting
very little is coming our way. So, right. It's really it's a record business thing that they're doing it. And if from a collecting standpoint, if you really think it's great, a package, and it's just something you got to have, great.
Okay, last question. You're going to be hitting the road pretty soon, playing for, you know, well over 100,000 people this year, most of which will never be able to thank you in person. How would you like to salute them as we conclude this interview?
The biggest thing between Iced Earth and our fans is that there's a huge loyalty factor that goes both ways. You know, the fans get it. They understand that, you know, there are people out there that look at things like Century Media has done here with the Slave to the Dark box set and say, ah, Schaefer's a greedy bastard. Well, you know what? We put out, on the European tour, we sold tour shirts for like 15 euros a piece that were full color, you know, 8 or 9 colors, front and back. Show me any band that has given that kind of a deal to the fan base. And I'm telling you, nobody has, because, you know, we obviously did a lot of research. So this has nothing to do with greed and money and, you know, the kind of shit that people say. You know, that this is, if I was out, you know, if I was, like, wanting to be rich, I wouldn't have started a heavy metal band and split from home when I was 16 years old. You know, it's not, and stuck with it for all these years. You know, there's a lot of other ways to really get rich, and it's not my motivation, let's put it that way. So the people that follow the band, they know this, you know, they know what Iced Earth is about. And that thing, that loyalty works both ways. The loyalty of that fan base that has been there, you know, some of them have been there for the last 20 years. Some of them just discovered us, but once they get into it, they're there. And it's a special thing to be involved in. And they know that. And I know it. And I realize how special it is. And I'm not going to ever take the fans for granted. And they just have to believe that and understand that, you know, this is the real deal. This is what we are. I am your inner fear. Your kind.